from Ground Zero Radio. This is Democracy Now in Exile.
I consider this as completely unethical, because if you have evidence, that's fine, but if you only have an assumption, that is playing with fire, and the Iraqi people, in my view, don't deserve to be again in a house that is about to be set on fire.
Former UN official Hans von Sponeck on Iraq and anthrax says the Bush administration looks at U.S. right-wing groups more closely. Massacre in the West Bank. Palestinians say Israeli soldiers have killed at least 50 people in the last week. And a leading Mexican human rights activist is assassinated. We'll speak with Chilean writer Ariel Dorfman. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile. This is the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. forces hammered Taliban front lines with cluster bombs as part of intense overnight raids on front lines north of Kabul, as the civilian toll of the U.S. and British air campaign and fears of a humanitarian catastrophe reached alarming proportions. The cluster bombs are fist-sized, armor-penetrating explosives that scatter over a wide area. The United Nations and many humanitarian organizations are urging the U.S. to stop using the weapon. Bombs that fail to explode on impact can continue to kill and maim civilians long afterwards. The UN says that people are currently trapped in their homes by unexploded bombs littering fields and roads. At least 16 people died in two overnight raids on the village of Takht Alaman, while a Taliban spokesperson said another 20 and maybe more were killed in Ishaq Salaman, both near the western city of Herat. U.S. jets hit a bus in Kandahar this morning, killing at least 10 civilians in a fiery explosion, according to Taliban officials and residents who witnessed the attack. With winter less than a month away, refugees fleeing U.S. bombing have emptied the cities to mass at the borders. And the U.S. is estimating that 1 million people have fled their homes and cities, and 70% are empty. The New York paper Newsday is reporting that the Bush administration fears that it might lose the public relations war in Muslim and Arab nations and is turning to Madison Avenue for help. The State Department is talking to the Advertising Council, a New York-based nonprofit group that develops advertising strategies for national causes, about crafting a, quote, public diplomacy campaign on the military action in Afghanistan and the so-called war on terrorism. Overseeing those talks is Charlotte Beers, the new Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and a former J. Walter Thompson advertising executive who started in the industry marketing Uncle Ben's rice. Her job now is to sell America, particularly to Muslim nations. And this news from Pakistan in Karachi, chanting anti-American slogans. More than 2,000 Islamists marched in Pakistan's city of Karachi today to bury a leading militant killed in U.S. raids on the Afghan capital of Kabul. Commander Farooq, a Karachi resident in his early 30s and leading member of the banned Islamic group Harakatul Mujahideen, was one of some 20 Pakistanis killed by U.S. bombing Tuesday in Kabul. His remains were smuggled back into Pakistan yesterday. This news from France. The President Jacques Chirac said today France has beefed up its military involvement in the U.S.-led attacks in Afghanistan by contributing spy planes and more ships. Chirac repeated that France is, in principle, ready to join special operations when the time comes. France has so far provided one refueling ship and one frigate supporting the U.S. Navy in the Indian Ocean, along with military bases and an unknown number of intelligence agents on the ground in Afghanistan. It has also opened up French airspace. And France has demanded the arrest of 15 Chilean military officials and civilians as part of a probe into the disappearances of 5 French citizens in Chile during the rule of former Augusto Pinochet, the former dictator. A French judge issued the warrants for alleged unlawful imprisonment and torture. Among the suspects named is Manuel Contreras, the former head of Pinochet's feared secret police. A French court has asked former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger to testify about what he knows about the disappearances which took place after the U.S.-backed coup against Salvador Allende. And this news from Nigeria, soldiers raided 6 villages in eastern Nigeria, razing homes and gunning down more than 100 civilians, apparently in revenge for the slaying of troops earlier this month. Soldiers were apparently searching for gunmen who kidnapped and killed 19 soldiers. Soldiers and armored personnel carriers rounded up and killed adult men and burned down homes throughout the area.
Listen to me. Whoa. It ain't nothing but a heartbreak. Whoa. Friend only to the undertaker.
And you are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. That's War, Edwin Starr. I'm Amy Goodman, and this last news on the home front. The Pacifica executive director, Bessie Wash, has been fired. The Pacifica board member, Pete Bramson, announced on station KPFA last night in Berkeley that Pacifica national board chair Bob Farrell fired Pacifica executive director Bessie Wash. He also said that Wash expressed concern about the action and indicated she may take legal action against Farrell or Pacifica. Meanwhile, the KPFA studios were evacuated yesterday due to a bomb threat. After police checked the building for about half an hour, the staff was back on the job. And as we turn to the issue of the war on Afghanistan, we also look at the home front and what's happening when it comes to anthrax. In the last few days, the Washington Post has been reporting that the United States is looking at the chemical additive and the anthrax spores mailed to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, saying that these chemical additives made the anthrax more lethal and involved sophisticated technology thought to be available in only 3 countries. The United States, Iraq, and the former Soviet Union are known to have developed 3 different types of anthrax preparations, which enable the spores to linger in the air, rendering them more lethal because they're easier to inhale. U.S. and Western companies sold Iraq many of the components to make biological weapons in the 1980s. Bush administration officials and the media have persistently tried to link Iraq either to the September 11th attacks or to the anthrax attacks of the last 2 weeks. Assistant Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, former CIA Director James Woolsey, and columnist William Sapphire, among others, have also pushed for the U.S. to extend the so-called war on terrorism to include attacks on Iraq. With attention focused on anthrax and the possibility of heavier attacks in Iraq, the mass media has largely ignored the ongoing impact of economic sanctions and the regular U.S. bombing of the country to enforce its unilaterally imposed no-fly zone. Now, the latest news is that the U.S. is setting its sights particularly not on Iraq, not on Russia, but on right-wing groups in the United States. The possibility that the anthrax came from right here at home. But on the issue of Iraq, we turn now to Hans von Sponeck, who is the former UN official in charge of the Oil for Food program in Iraq. He resigned in protest in 1999 of the effect that the sanctions and the bombing was having on the population. Hans von Sponeck, can you talk about this issue that's being raised over and over again of the possibility of the anthrax coming from Iraq?
Well, I would say there is absolutely no evidence at this stage that points to Iraq. The Antrax accusation is a part of a wider effort to set the stage by those who want to see Iraq to be included in an attack against terrorism. To now argue that Iraq has played a role in this deadly game, and unfortunately, Richard Butler has added his voice yet again to this without offering any evidence.
And explain again for us who Richard Butler is.
Richard Butler is the former head of the UN disarmament group called UNSCOM. He dropped out in early 2000 from this appointment, and he also was the one who was, in a way, the key in December 1998 to facilitate the ultimate decision by the U.S. government and the British to bomb Iraq from the 16th to the 20th of December 1998. And he now conjectures and speculates in the media that Iraq could be considered as one of the possible originators of anthrax in the United States. I consider this as completely unethical, because if you have evidence, that's fine, but if you only have an assumption, that is playing with fire, and the Iraqi people, in my view, don't deserve to be again in a house that is about to be set on fire.
Who is it that wants to attack Iraq and is using this as a pretext?
Well, I mean, it is the rhetoric buildup in some parts of the U.S. media is quite visible in Europe. When you read articles by Lowry Mulroy, who published this book, Saddam Hussein's Unfinished War Against Iraq, and then you hear the statements by Wolfsley or Wolfowitz, then you become frightened, because it's all without evidence, and you cannot develop a policy and ultimately a plan to handle another country on the basis of conjectures. I think this is highly irresponsible, and the anthrax accusation against Iraq is part of that. If there's evidence, that's a different story, but at this point, it's nothing but very wild speculation.
What about General Powell's role in this, the Secretary of State?
I think the Secretary of State impresses us in Europe very much, which is much more measured approach to these. We thought in the beginning we would face a hardliner in this difficult and complex Iraq discussion. Now we find a very reasonable, much more reasonable, much more measured person compared to his counterparts in the Defense Department, like Mr. Rumsfeld and Mr. Wolfowitz.
My last question to you, Hans von Sponeck, and that is the idea that these three countries are the ones that have them, that would have the possibility of putting this chemical on, Russia, Iraq, and the United States. And again, big emphasis on looking at right-wing groups now in the United States, something
right.
We've been doing for quite a while. But when they say Iraq has that ability, is it an ability that actually came from the United States, as a lot of the bioweapons did?
Well, I'm very glad that you asked that question. I think it's only fair to remember that a lot of the ingredients for a weapon of mass destruction program came from the West. It came from the British. It came very much from the Americans. It came from other Western European companies. So it is to be remembered that Iraq isn't an entity that created all this by itself. It needed massive outside investment to get to the stage where it became a threat to the international community. But I'm afraid today, only those who want to see Iraq put down now and find causes to do so will point the finger at this point at Iraq, because Iraq has, for all practical purposes, as it was said well by Mr. Cohen, William Cohen, Defense Secretary, when he briefed incoming President Bush in early January of 2000, he said, Iraq does no longer pose a threat to its neighbors. And I think the anthrax issue, biological warfare in general, as far as Iraq is concerned, I do not believe that Iraq today constitutes a threat, and I also don't think that Iraq is involved in the current anthrax case.
Hans von Sponeck, you quit the UN after running the oil for food program in Iraq and calling it genocidal.
No, I did not.
You didn't?
I did not call it genocidal in the early stages, but the more I look at the situation now, I think I've come to the conclusion that there is an element of intent here, and where intent is and people suffer and die in scores every month, as repeatedly stressed by international agencies like CARE International, like Caritas, the International Red Cross, the UN, then I think one can begin to argue, which I very reluctantly do, that there is a tendency towards genocide and a violation of the Genocide Convention.
Well, I wanted to ask, before the attacks of September 11th, it seemed that the clearly the international coalition was falling apart even further around Iraq and imposing the sanctions, that there was a lot of headway
Yes.
that was being made by people like you who've been just spending your time speaking around the world around the sanctions. Now, with this whole question of whether to bomb Iraq or not, it seems sanctions is off the table as a discussion point, that they will remain. Is what you're finding right now?
Yes, I think there is a tug of war behind the scenes, so to speak, in the U.S. administration between those who want to go ahead with including Iraq in a second line of attack and those who caution against this. And I think this is yet another example, a painful example, to show that a political battle is fought on the back of people. And 23 million Iraqi people cannot be considered wrongdoers, but they are now again being marginalized, and the sanction discussion is off the table at the moment, but not for long, because at the end of November, early December, the Oil for Food program comes to an end and has to be renegotiated. At that time, the question of sanctions, and particularly smart sanctions, the UK, British, and American proposals, will be on the table again. And I think that is then forcing the Security Council, and particularly the United States, to take a clear position. And so it's not off the table for long.
What do you mean by smart sanctions?
Well, the smart sanctions, of course, are the proposal by the British to get out of this dead-end road of the last 11 years with comprehensive economic sanctions, arguing that by freeing the import of civilian goods, the Iraqis will be able to live again, which is a totally wrong and maliciously misleading statement, because concurrently with that freer inflow of humanitarian supplies is a containment, the secure borders without any chance of Iraq to illegally or extra-legally exporting oil. While this on the surface sounds quite sound, behind it is something very evil, because under sanctions, Iraq is not getting one single dollar to finance its national administration. No money to pay civil servant salaries, no money for teachers, no money for upkeep of hospitals, roads, infrastructure. And if that money has come to a very large extent from this extra income. If you deprive Iraq from securing such income, then you are strangulating Iraqi civilians, and they will suffer more, not less. So smart sanctions are not smart at all. And if you introduce in the year 2001 smart sanctions, then one can only wonder what the sanctions were the previous 11 years.
You're off to the United Nations today. What are you doing?
Well, I'm meeting this morning with the Russian ambassador to the United Nations to discuss with him the whole approach after the end of the Oil for Food program in November. I think the Russians play a very key role in ensuring that there isn't a total following of the U.S. and British position, which would definitely make life Iraqis. More difficult, and I think this key role of the Russians needs to be discussed, and I hope that the Russian government will have the strength to stick to the position that they had at the time when the smart sanctions were tabled the first time, and that was in June of last year, and simply rejected. This has to end. Sanctions have to be lifted, economic sanctions, a military embargo must be in place, not just for Iraq, but also on the sellers, those who intend to sell weapons to Iraq. And in that whole discussion, the Russians, and I would also look to the French and the Chinese as permanent members of the Security Council, have a very key role to play to bring this whole discussion back to reason and to a sane approach in targeting the wrongdoer and not the civilian population that has been the target for the past 11 years.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Hans von Sponeck.
My pleasure.
Hans von Sponeck, former head of the UN Oil for Food Program, he quit and left Baghdad. He's now speaking in the United States. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile. Back in a minute.
The way God created to do. This is a mean old world to live in.
Oh, I hear
a mean old world to live in until you die.
This is a mean world
to try to live in, to try to stay in until you die. This is a mean world to try to live in, to try to stay in until you die. Without a mother, without a father, without a sister, Lord, without a brother. This is a mean world to try to live in, to try to stay in until you die. This is a mean old world to live in.
Oh, I see.
A mean old world to live in until you die.
This is a mean world. Sweet Honey in the Rock, their CD in this land, here on Democracy Now! In Exile, the War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli forces left the West Bank village of Beit Rima early today after a bloody raid. The raid was sealed off from the world's media by the Israeli army. Palestinian leadership is describing it as a massacre. Hundreds of Israeli troops swept through the village in the barren hills north of Ramallah, bursting into homes, hauling off around 50 men at gunpoint. Palestinian sources say Israeli soldiers killed 9 Palestinians in Beit Rima alone. The raid was part of an Israeli invasion of several West Bank villages, which Palestinians say has left more than 50 Palestinians dead. No Israeli has been killed. Israel launched the invasion after the assassination of its right-wing tourism minister. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon took a political gamble when he ignored a toughly worded U.S. demand Monday to get out immediately and stay out of the West Bank towns. But after Sharon's refusal, President Bush softened his line, calling for withdrawal as soon as possible. Sharon is now set to meet top ministers to discuss a possible pullout of the West Bank, but the killing continues on the ground. In Bethlehem, which has been a flashpoint in the latest invasions, Israeli soldiers shot dead a 20-year-old Palestinian policeman. We're going to go to Israel right now. We're joined by someone in the Dehesha refugee camp just outside Bethlehem. In our studio, Ziad Abbas is with us, founder of the Dehesha refugee camp, youth program that is there, as well as we will speak with an Israeli human rights lawyer. We welcome you all to the War and Peace Report. Ziad Abbas, can you tell us the latest news you have out of Bethlehem?
The last news is 1 hour ago that the Israeli army killed 2 Palestinians in Bethlehem area. And still the clashes continue there in Bethlehem. They are still shelling the city, and especially they concentrate in the 2 refugee camps, Azza camp and Aida camp. Around 7,000 persons living in these 2 refugee camps, and it's already surrounded by the Israeli army, and some of the soldiers, they occupied the roofs of the houses, and they are shooting anything moving inside the camp. Some families, since 1 week, they are stuck in their houses. They cannot leave the houses. They don't have enough food. They don't have enough water. And of course, no electricity, because all the time the Israeli army, when they start attack, they attack the generators of the electricity in the Beit Lahem city in general. At the same time, Beit Jala city is face the same problem, because the tanks is still there since 1 week now, and they're still searching in the houses, destroyed everything in the houses, and we don't know how many persons they were arrested. But the situation in Beit Lahem, which today that you spoke about the massacre in Beit Rima, but I can see there is a massacre in Beit Lahem since 1 week, but they do it slowly. And I believe if Sharon will continue that, it will be a big massacre in the Dehesha refugee camp.
We are joined by Manar Farag in the Dehesha refugee camp. Can you tell us the scene on the ground right now?
About the situation here, I can't explain it well, because there are no words to explain this hard happen. But I can say they are killing us every day and every place in Palestine. We are in the jail. We can't breathe. We can't sleep. Our life, it is a miserable life. The children, they don't know about bomb. They don't know about music or any place to play. They know if this bomb or this voice for M16 or F16, or it is a big bomb. But we are not afraid from them. And I say this because I mean it, not like the political people who are always speak, and there is nothing new or good from them. I hate the politics. I'm just to speak about the reality here. And the reality, it is so hard, and it hurts a lot. And it say, I speak with you today, but I don't know, maybe now or after I speak or after I finish with you, boom, come here and kill me. But we love the death if it is for the God and for Palestine.
Manar Farag speaking to us from the Dehesha refugee camp. This, what is going on in Beit Lahem, particularly what is going on in Beit Rima right now, the raid was sealed off from the world's media. I wanted to turn to Leah Tzemel, who is the first Israeli lawyer to defend Palestinians accused of engaging in armed struggle in the early 80s. She's an Israeli human rights lawyer. What information have you gotten? Is what's happening in Beit Rima, are people, Israelis, as cut off from this information, civilians?
Our problem nowadays is that we have very little information. The areas where the army acts are usually closed to the public, even closed to the media. And we get some telephones. If the telephone network works, very often it does not work. There is, as was said before, hardly any electricity, etc. So we gather up information from different people and from the Israeli news, which is very limited. We can also get some information from doctors or human rights organizations. And the last news we had is about the Trima, where the corpse remained, or people were left to die for hours and hours without any medical help, although doctors, both Israelis and Palestinians, were there in the vicinity ready to help. They were not allowed close to the wounded people. All in all, I can say from my place, which is within the Israeli, Israel and within the Israeli society, that we feel in a terrible situation. The right wing in Israel is celebrating. There was a very strong, big demonstration of about 80,000 people calling for more war, calling for, to kill Arafat and the Palestinians, death to the Palestinians in Jerusalem. And the feeling that there is a fascist atmosphere is becoming greater every day.
Leah Tzemel, Israeli human rights lawyer. Manar Farag, can you explain specifically in the Dehesha refugee camp what happens on the ground? Have us when Israeli soldiers come in, what exactly are they doing?
Where? What?
Israeli soldiers, have they come into the Dehesha refugee camp, as we've heard described?
Around the camp.
Around the camp. Mm. And what are they doing when they go into this area around the camp in Bethlehem? Well, Ziad.
Usually the Israeli army, when they enter the Bethlehem area, first they reach the Aida refugee camp and Azza refugee camp. The tanks, the soldiers, they don't move on the ground, only the tanks. And the tanks shelling everywhere around, and anything move. I have this story about Rana. She's from Beit Jala. She was driving her car. They shot her car. She was injured in the beginning. After that, she left the car. She started walking, try to save her life. But after that, they shot her and they killed her. This is the one example. At the same time, there's a handicapped person from Azza refugee camp. The soldiers, the snipers on the roofs of the houses, they were controlling the streets. Anyone go outside his house, when they move inside the streets, they shoot him. The tanks everywhere, the tanks in the main streets around the camps, the soldiers on the roofs of the houses, which know it's not possible to leave your house. At the same time, you cannot reach the Bethlehem Hospital, which is in the center of Bethlehem. And the hospital itself, it was bombed many times, and one doctor was injured, and one person, he was killed in the entrance of the hospital, which everything in Bethlehem, it's closed. The people cannot move, only few streets inside the city between the builders, the buildings where the people can move. In the main streets, no one can move, not by car, even walking.
What are the young people calling for in the refugee camp and in the cultural center, the youth program that you run there?
The main call for us, we are calling the international community, we are calling the USA government, that we are looking and waiting for international protection, because what the Israeli is doing now, right now, it's a massacre against the Palestinian people in front of the international community, and no one pay attention for that. And Sharon and his government use this opportunity, because the international community focusing in Afghanistan, and he think he can do everything against the Palestinian people. And this is actually what he did. Last 10 days, more than 50 person killed in Palestine, and hundreds they are injured, and tens of people they were arrested. This is it, they mean it. The question, the main call for us, we are looking immediately for international protection for the Palestinian children, for Palestinian women, for everyone living there.
There's a piece in the Washington Post today about how Shimon Peres, who was in the United States, was talking about trying to get Sharon to stop comparing Yasser Arafat to Osama bin Laden. What do you think about that?
If the Israeli government, they will succeed a little bit to deceive the international public opinion, to show the Palestinian people or to show PLO as the terrorist groups, maybe they can succeed in the beginning, especially when they cooperate with the USA government. But the, for us as a Palestinian, we are struggling. We have a right for that. We are not a terrorist group. We are struggling for our rights. We are calling for to implementing the United Nations resolution, which speak clearly about Palestine. And for the Israeli government, we have the two faces. Yani, for me, Peres and Sharon, it's the same. Because Sharon, he do the things on the field. Peres, he tried to make it nice. He tried to give the nice face for Israel in front of the international public opinion. This is a joint government from both party. And Peres, actually, when he was a prime minister, he did the same massacre in Cana a few years ago, which it is not different.
One of the things that we've looked at in terms of media coverage when there's Labour in power or Likud is that under Labour, in fact, more settlements were built in the West Bank and Gaza. There's the sense that Labour is very different.
Actually, for us as a Palestinian living there in the field, in the refugee camps, for us, we don't see any differences between Labour and Likud, only according to their political speeches. In general, what they did in the field, the settlements built during the Labour movements more than during the Likud. The same massacres during the Labour government, during the Likud government, they are the same. They are implementing the Zionist project against the Palestinian people.
We're joined on the telephone now by Hadass Ziv, who's in Tel Aviv with Physicians for Human Rights. Are you with us?
Yes.
I understand that you're saying that the Israeli army did not let in medics into Beit Rima yesterday. How did you try to get in? How did people try to get in?
Actually, Dr. Mustafa Baraguti from the medical relief turned to us early in the morning saying that the ambulances of the Red Crescent Society and one of the medical relief are waiting outside the village wanting to enter. So we called the Israeli coordinator, telling them that they are waiting at the checkpoint and please let them in. They later verified that indeed they did not let them in, and only at, let's say, 10 past 8, actually all the medical teams could get in. Later they said that in those 3 to 4 hours where the wounded lied bleeding, Israeli medics got in and they found no reason to let the Palestinian teams in. But we called the Palestinian doctor in Beit Rima, who's a resident of Beit Rima, and he said that his neighbor told him that there are wounded people, but the Israeli army did not let him reach them until after 8 o'clock.
Do you have...
We find the... What?
Go ahead.
We found the Israeli army versions a bit contradictory, because when we spoke to the coordinator, we heard nothing about Israeli teams that entered, and they verified our suspicion that only after 8 o'clock they got medical treatment. So I don't know which version to believe now, the first Israeli version or the other Israeli version. But according to the Palestinian doctor who saw the wounded, to his impression, he was bleeding for quite a considerable amount of time before they reached him.
And do you have any figures on casualties?
We know that there are, for certain, we know that there are 3 wounded people in Tel HaShomer Hospital in the surrounding of Tel Aviv. And we know that there are 5 who were killed. We do not know if there are more who were killed. The number figures between 5 and 8 or 5 to 10. So we are sure that there were 5 that were killed and 3 that are wounded and are hospitalized in Israel.
And how does this situation compare in terms of getting into areas that other situations in the past to what happened in Beit Rima today and yesterday?
The situation in the last year has deteriorated considerably because the checkpoints and the Israeli army controls every exit and entry into almost every village. So even to, let's say, regular patients, it's very difficult to get into hospital and to medical treatment in routine days. But this time it's even more, I would say, threatening, because everyone knew that there are wounded people and they did not let in medical teams. So it's against all the regulation, against all. We went to the High Court several times against the army on these issues, and it's against everything that they've agreed upon. It's against our values. It's against what every day they say that they believe in. So I find it a bit distressing, not a bit, I find it very distressing, because it's a deterioration even of the image that they want to put on. But they don't really care anymore.
You're Israeli?
Yes.
Ziad Abbas, right now, how do you feel that the war on Afghanistan, the bombing of Afghanistan, that Sharon is using this time to particularly intensify the attacks on Palestinians, as the focus is, media focus is more on Afghanistan?
Actually, the war in Afghanistan and what the U.S. is doing there, this is a good opportunity for Sharon to use that against the Palestinians. And now Sharon, he try in a way or another to raise that the Palestinian leadership, BLO, became like Taliban, which he wanted to have the right to bomb the Palestinian. But actually, the Palestinian, they are bombed since long time. Now, 1 year, more than 1 year, Sharon and Barak, before they were bombed the Palestinian areas. Sharon, he have his own program, which is he don't have anything politically toward the Palestinian issue. He don't have real solution for the Palestinian. Just he think that he want to force the Palestinian to accept any political solution in the future, which is not related to the Palestinian political rights. What he's doing now, it's something related to the program, to the history of Sharon, and to the history of the Israeli leadership in general. If we return back to the history, Sharon, he was one of the main leaders inside Israel. He was accused on his responsibility in 1982 about Sabra and Shatila massacre. And now he became a prime minister. The problem is not with Sharon himself as a Sharon. The problem is with the people they were elected. They were voted for Sharon. And this is the real problem we face it as a Palestinian people, that the Israeli street still believe this the ideology. They still concentrate on this goal. They want to build the pure Jewish state without Palestinian. And the policy now, what we see in the Palestinian areas, in the Palestinian cities, it's clear ethnic cleansing against the Palestinian people. And our other problem, which the international community ignore, what's going on there.
Manar Farag in the Dehesha refugee camp, where Ziad Abbas just was and is now here in the United States, but actually lives in the refugee camp. How do you lead your life each day now? How are you protecting yourself?
Are you with me? Like I said before, I don't know if I will still alive. Because the bomb around us everywhere, and the die, the death, and the shelling, bombing everywhere, and we can't go to school and to the hospital because. Because the tanks around the hospital and around my school, I can't speak English very well, but really the situation here, it's so difficult and so hard. I'm sorry I can't speak English very well, but...
Manar, you're how old?
I'm 15 years old.
Were you in South Africa for the UN Conference Against Racism?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was there.
And did you feel like there was any progress that has been made from then until now?
Excuse me?
Did you feel like there's any progress, or if things only gotten worse since you were in South Africa just a month or two ago?
No, nothing.
أي تطور يعني منار أي تطور صار في مؤتمر جنوب أفريقيا شعرتي في أي تطور هناك صار معك وانت في جنوب أفريقيا في السياسة العامة؟
Of course, the people there understood us, and they are with us. But about the leaders, about the government, there is nothing. And I'm sorry for that, but there is the really. And we don't have anything from this forum.
You were in New York on September 11th when the attack on the World Trade Center took place?
Yes, I was.
What were your thoughts on that day?
What?
What were your thoughts and feelings on that day? You can try.
إيش شعرتي منار؟ إيش شعرتي منار في هذاك اليوم؟ شو كان شعورك وأنت موجودة في نيويورك لما الحادث صار؟
Of course, it's hard heaven, but and a history heaven, but I think I don't know. I think the people there, they are.
You can say it in Arabic, and Ziad will translate.
تقدر تحكي بالعربي منار. منار تقدر تحكي بالعربي وأنا
بترجم حبيبتي. I think the people there, they are victims, or for them government, because. Because they don't know anything.
بالعربي حبيبتي.
طيب.
Let me.
يعني أنا بحكي إن هذول ضحايا لحكوماتهم. يعني بقدرش أحكي أي إشي عنهم.
I cannot speak anything on behalf of the victims, but she believed that the victims they were killed in the World Trade Center, they are victims for the policy of their government.
And Ziad Abbas, you too were here. You're just here for a few weeks before you go back to the Dehesha refugee camp where you live. What were your thoughts on September 11th?
Actually, for us as a Palestinian people, because we understand what means suffering, we understand what means when you lose some of your relatives, your brothers, your sisters, your son, etc. And we had this since 53 years now, since 48. And we have this experience, not on the way that we get used to it. No, it's not easy to lose someone from your family or some lovers related to you. It was very hard to see that. It is it's a real catastrophe to see that the victims killing and dying in a few minutes. We are against that totally. We are against any civilian to be killed. But I believe, let us to use what happened in September 11th. They are victims. We are against that totally, and no doubts for that. But let us to use this incident to stop other attacks in the future, other victims, to try to save other lives of the other people. And now we can see everywhere. We hear about war in Afghanistan, but what we hear about hundreds of civilians, they are killed inside Afghanistan, and hospitals bombed, people, they are suffering there, more refugees. And we as Palestinian refugees now, we feel that what's mean to be refugees, and especially in front of this international public opinion. I believe it's enough for this bloody policies in this world, which it is created by the new world system, the way how they want to design the new world, the way how they want to design the human rights, the way how they want to design the future of the people. It's hard to accept it. And let us to relate it to the international human rights, to relate to return back to try to implement the Human Rights Convention, try to achieve the justice and real justice among the world in general in different countries.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. If people want to find out more about the Ibda Cultural Center in the Dahisha refugee camp, where can they go on the web or get information?
First of all, we have our own website, which is Dahisha, Dahisha ibda.net, and they can contact Madri Organization in New York, which it's a sister organization and one of the main donors and funders for us in New York.
And that's Madre in New York. And we'll have all that information on our website at webactive.com. I want to thank you very much for coming in. Also, for our listeners who are viewing this on public access stations or on Dish Network channel 9415, that's Free Speech TV, incredible footage from inside the refugee camp. And thank you for that. We've been speaking with Ziad Abbas, founder of the Ibda Cultural Center in Dahisha refugee camp, and on the telephone from the camp, Manar Farag, as well as Hadass Ziv, who's with Physicians for Human Rights in Tel Aviv, and before that, Leah Tzemel, the Israeli human rights lawyer. You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be joined by Ariel Dorfman talking about the Mexican human rights activist who was just assassinated. Stay with us.
They made their world so hard. Every day we got to keep on fighting. Keep us.
one drop, Bob Marley and the Wailers from the CD Survival, here on the War and Peace Report. This is Free Speech Radio as we break the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. While the world looks east to the U.S. war in Afghanistan, many atrocities in other places are being overlooked. In Mexico, internationally renowned human rights attorney Digna Ochoa y Plácido was assassinated in her office on Friday. Ochoa represented some of the most difficult and politically charged human rights cases in Mexico, many involving torture or murder by Mexico's military and security forces. She represented the widows of the Aguas Blancas massacre, the campesino ecologists of Guerrero, and most recently, the Cerezo brothers, who were accused of setting bombs in front of Citibank offices. A co-worker discovered the body in her office with gunshots to her head. We're joined on the telephone now by Ariel Dorfman, who is a Chilean-American writer, professor at Duke University, and author of a number of books, plays, short stories, including Speak Truth to Power, Voices from Beyond the Dark, his latest Blake's Therapy. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Hello, Amy. I'm glad to be able to speak about Digna on this program.
Well, it's very good to have you with us. Your play dealt with Digna. In fact, you incorporated her own words
exactly.
into it.
Exactly. I'm going to be reading from that just to explain to our listeners what this is. This is a play which is based upon interviews done by Kerry Kennedy Cuomo, who went around the world, collecting these stories in the own words of the people. They were long, long interviews. I worked them over with some of the people, like Digna herself, and created a play out of this, which was opened at the Kennedy Center, where there were people such as Kevin Kline, John Malkovich, Sigourney Weaver, Alec Baldwin, and Alfre Woodard did the voice and the life of Digna Ochoa on stage. And this is, in fact, the play doesn't quite open with her, but it's the first long monologue in which I sort of ground the whole idea of the defense of human rights in this very small, frail, incredibly energetic and courageous woman who had been threatened with death. I'm going to read this, and I think it's the best possible introduction and homage to her, and then we can talk a bit more about my relationship with her and what this means in relation especially to Mexico and human rights everywhere. So she says, "My name is Digna Ochoa. I am a nun who started life as a lawyer. My father was a union leader in Veracruz, Mexico. In the sugar factory where he worked, he was involved in the struggles for running water, roads, and securing land certificates. I studied law because I was always hearing that my father and his friends needed more lawyers, and all the lawyers charged so much. My father was unjustly jailed for 1 year and 15 days. He was then disappeared, desaparecido, and tortured. The charges against him were fabricated. This led to my determination to do something for those suffering injustice because I saw it in the flesh with my father. The first case I worked on was against judicial police officers who had been involved in the illegal detention and torture of several peasants. First, telephone messages came telling me to drop the case. Then by mail, threats that if I didn't drop it, I would die, or members of my family would be killed. I kept working, and we even publicly reported what was happening. Then I was disappeared and held incomunicado for 8 days by the police. They wanted me to give them all the evidence against them. I had hidden the case file well, not in my office, not in my house, and not where the victims lived, because I was afraid the police would steal it. Now I felt in the flesh what my father had felt, what the people had suffered. Later, when I managed to escape from the torture house where they were holding me, I started to work with Centro Pro. And since then, I've handled a lot of cases, people like my father and people like me. I've always felt anger at the suffering of others. For me, anger is energy. It's a force. If an act of injustice doesn't provoke anger in me, it could be seen as indifference, passivity. It's injustice that motivates us to do something, to take risks. But if we don't, things will remain the same. Anger has made us confront police and soldiers. Something that I discovered is that the police and soldiers are used to the superiors shouting at them and used to being mistreated. So when they run into a woman, otherwise seems significant to them, who dresses monk-like and demands things of them and shouts at them in an authoritarian way, they are paralyzed. One time we filed a habeas corpus on behalf of a man who had been disappeared for 20 days. The authorities denied having him in custody and denied us access to the state hospital where we knew he was being held. I spent a whole morning studying the comings and goings at the hospital to see how I could get in. During a change in shifts, I slipped in. When I got to the door of the room where this person was, the nurse at the door told me I couldn't go in. I told her that I would take care of myself. All I asked was if they did something to me, she should call a certain number. I gave her my card. I took a deep breath, opened the door violently, and yelled at the federal judicial police officers inside. I told them they had to leave immediately because I was this person's lawyer and needed to speak with him. They didn't know how to react, so they left. I had 2 minutes, but it was enough to explain who I was, that I'd been in touch with his wife, and to get him to sign a piece of paper proving that he was in the hospital. He signed. By then, the police came back. Fierce they were. They tried to grab me to get me out of there. They didn't expect me to assume an attack position. The only position in karate I knew from movies, I suppose. Of course, I don't really know karate, but they thought I was going to attack. Trembling inside, I said that if they laid a hand on me, they'd see what would happen. And they drew back, saying, "You're threatening us." And I said, "Take it any way you want." Now that was Digna Choa.
Ariel Dorfman reading from his play, The Words of Digna Choa, who was assassinated last Friday. Human rights activist in Mexico. In our last minutes, Ariel Dorfman, can you put her death in a larger picture, if this is possible, of what is taking place now in the war in Afghanistan, or the attention that we're not paying to what is south of the border and what is happening there? Though fast track is certainly being pushed through quick enough.
Well, let's very clearly look at the fact that the world in the last 10 to 15 years has been filled with all sorts of people with terrible, tremendous, and absolutely justified grievances. These people rise up. They rise up against censorship. They rise up for freedom, for liberty, for all the things that supposedly we are defending around the world. But in fact, very often we don't. But that's the crux of the matter. In Mexico, that has particularly been the case. There has been a real flowering, blossoming of human rights movements all over Mexico and all over Latin America, everywhere. Now, the central issue is who defends those people once they are repressed by the police, and is generally lawyers or human rights defenders. Of that group, Digna Ochoa was the most prominent. She is perhaps one of the most prominent human rights lawyers in the whole world, not only in Mexico. So when she is threatened, as she has been during the last few years, what we are seeing is an attempt to stop those who defend all those around the world who are looking for a more just society, who are in fact fighting the consequences of corporate globalization as opposed to human and humanitarian globalization, which I certainly agree with, you know. And she's part of that human rights movement, which is part of a global movement that addresses all of this. So I think this is my impression. That one of the things that has happened is because the U.S. is in Afghanistan and it needs all its allies behind it, they are going to turn a blind eye to all the abuses of authority that are happening. One of the basic problems here is that the Fox government came in promising to stop these abuses, to investigate all these people. Instead, what has happened is the most prominent human rights lawyer of Mexico has been assassinated. And, of course, this is intimidating to everybody in Latin America and everybody in Mexico as well. Therefore, it would seem to me to be a good moment in which President Bush could call his friend Vicente Fox and say, I want the murderers of Digna Ochoa put on trial.
On that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Ariel Dorfman, writer, playwright. Thank you. And that does it for today's program, Democracy Now in Exile, produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, Anthony Sloan, our technical director, Errol Maitland at the helm at WBIX.org. At the top of the program, I reported that one of the board members, Pete Bramson, said the chair of the board, Bob Farrell, had called him to say that Bessie Wash, the executive director, had been fired. Now, apparently, another board member, the vice chair, has gone on WBAI's air and said that Bessie Wash has not been fired. We are following the story, and we'll keep you updated. We are broadcasting just blocks from the World Trade Center towers, where they once stood, in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Resisting against the system. Fighting.
From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
And terrified as I am of Muslim fundamentalists as a Muslim, I must also say that I'm equally terrified of the fundamentalism of the market.
Today on the War and Peace Report, an hour with Farid Issak, a leading Muslim liberation theologian. He's from South Africa, a former fighter with the African National Congress. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations and humanitarian organizations are urging the U.S. to stop using the devastating anti-personnel cluster bombs it's been dropping on the Afghan capital of Kabul. Taliban spokespeople say U.S. bombing killed at least 36 people in two villages near the western city of Herat. U.S. jets also hit a bus in Kandahar this morning, killing at least 10 civilians. The U.N. is estimating that a million people have fled their homes because of U.S. bombing, emptying major cities as refugees mass at the borders. And the Bush administration is turning to the Advertising Council, a New York-based nonprofit that develops advertising strategies for national causes, about crafting a public diplomacy campaign on the war in Afghanistan. Overseeing the talks are Charlotte Beers, the Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy, and a former J. Walter Thompson advertising exec who started in the industry marketing Uncle Ben's rice. The Washington Post reports today a chemical additive in anthrax spores mailed to the Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle involves sophisticated technology thought to be available in only three countries, including the United States. Federal officials now appear to be looking more closely at the possibility that the attacks are the work of right-wing groups here in the United States. And this news from Ireland, the IRA announced yesterday it's put some weapons beyond use in what's widely seen as a historic breakthrough for the Northern Ireland peace process. The move could lead to the restoration of Northern Ireland's power-sharing executive if unionist parties agree. We're joined right now by Gretty Horgan, human rights and peace activist. Can you talk about the significance of yesterday's announcement?
It's really a huge breakthrough for peace here in Northern Ireland. Basically, over the last 4 or 5 years, actually for the last 7 years, there's been a great level of peace here, with the IRA guns being entirely silenced. However, there's been a sort of a push from mainly the unionists, and particularly the anti-agreement unionists, those who really don't want to see power sharing and don't want to see civil rights here, have used the question of the IRA arms not being decommissioned as a block for progress on the development of new structures here. And really what's great about the decommissioning of the IRA arms is not so much what it means in terms of the availability of arms for anybody who does want to be involved in terrorism. After all, they can just go and buy some more if they want to do that. But what it does do is it sort of takes away the excuse from the anti-agreement people who haven't wanted to see a new society emerging here in Northern Ireland.
Gretty Horgan, we also understand two people were arrested yesterday in County Down. Who were they?
They were Republican dissidents, they were arrested with a submachine gun in the car. I think what that really says is that the probably real IRA people, what are called the real IRA, and they are a very, very small group. They represent a tiny minority on the island of Ireland. And really the fact that they were arrested as they drove along a motorway suggests that the police knew exactly who they were and what they were going to do. And one of the reasons why very few people in Northern Ireland are concerned about these dissident Republican groups is because clearly they're infiltrated at every level by the security forces, by the secret police.
Gretty Horgan, finally, you have worked for peace in Ireland for more than 30 years. You have organized trade union rallies before the ceasefire that brought tens of thousands of people into the streets. Do you think that yesterday's breakthrough will make a major difference at this point?
As I said earlier, I think the main breakthrough is in terms of the atmosphere here and the fact that those who have been trying to resist a more just and equal society here no longer have the excuse of the fact that the IRA had not decommissioned any arms. Now the ball is back in their court. Are they willing to accept, for example, more human rights legislation? Are they willing to accept that we need to have legislation that's going to ensure equality between Catholics and Protestants, between men and women? Are they going to just throw up more obstacles? And already, I'm afraid, there are some signs that some of the unionists are going to be throwing up more obstacles, and they're saying that this isn't enough. You know, they want evidence that the IRA is completely broken up, you know, that it no longer exists and stuff like that.
Garrity Horgan, I want to thank you very much for being with us, speaking to us from Derry, Northern Ireland, human rights and peace activist, as we move now to Edwin Starr's War.
Then, of course, there is revolutionary love. Love of comrades fighting for the people and love of people. Not an abstract people, but people one meets and works with. When Che Guevara talked of love being at the center of revolutionary endeavor, he meant both. For people like Che or George Jackson or Malcolm X, love was the prime mover of their struggle, and love cost them their lives. Love, coupled with a man's pride. Love, coupled with a man's pride.
Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report. We are the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. In the 6 weeks since the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the mainstream media has flooded the airwaves and newspapers with glib commentary about the nature of Islam. President Bush assuring Americans that Islam equals peace and whether or not the Taliban or groups like Al-Qaeda are authentic Muslims. Just this morning, AP, for example, quoted an influential Shiite Muslim cleric once linked to Islamic militants who said he doesn't believe the September 11th hijackers committed an act of martyrdom, which he says is a prized duty in Islam, but suicide, a crime in the faith. The media has spent much of the time contrasting moderate and by implication legitimate Muslims in the West with militant and by implication illegitimate Islam in Central Asia and the Middle East. But as Professor Edward Said has noted, there's no one Islam, but a plurality of Islams reflecting a plurality of religious and political agendas. We now turn to Faridi Saq. He's a Muslim scholar who's lived the diversity of Islam from Pakistan to South Africa and developed what many call an Islamic theology of liberation. Joining us in our Firehouse studio, welcome to Democracy Now in Exile.
Thank you very much, Amy. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you with us. I should also say Farida Saq is in New York as a visiting scholar, visiting professor of theology at Auburn Seminary. A leading Muslim figure in the anti-apartheid struggle, active member of the ANC, and in the last 4 years has been the head of the Gender Equality Commission of the South African government. Well, first, I'd just like to get your reaction to the September 11th attacks. Where were you when they happened?
I was in Manhattan. I was in Uptown Manhattan, and although I had been to New York several times, I had never seen Twin Towers. I think I had been spared that sight. And so it was surreal. It was TV, it was film, it was drama. I must also say that the afternoon of the attack and the subsequent days, although I was deeply pained by what I saw, just a few days before that, I was in the southern Sudan and in the north of Uganda. And there I saw, if you're looking for a real atrocity, there I saw the devastation on thousands of Christians wreaked by the Sudanese regime. And I also saw the devastation wreaked by the Lord's army in northern Uganda, a Christian fundamentalist group every bit as obscurantist as the Taliban. And the thing then that struck me very vividly was how those are black lives. And the fact that there are hundreds and thousands in the last few years that have been killed, it just doesn't matter. They're not white lives. There are no TV cameras. There are no fundamental economic objectives being threatened. And so, although my heart goes out to all the pain that I see around me, I couldn't be helped but be struck at how indifferent people are to black lives, to cheap lives, and now we see to Afghani lives, really. I mean, when they're not white and when the TV cameras aren't around, when it doesn't... So I must say I was very ambivalent in being caught up in all the pain around me and at the same time the memories of northern Uganda and southern Sudan still very much a part of my experiences of those days.
Can you talk about how you as a Muslim and a scholar of Islam explain the attacks and the deeply conservative variant of Islam practiced by the Taliban and others in the region?
Incidentally, I spent 8 years in a theological seminary where in many of the Taliban people studied with me. Some of my professors are now ministers in the Taliban government. So I know much more than what meets the eye.
Where?
In Pakistan.
Where in Pakistan?
In Karachi and also in the north of Pakistan. I think that it is part of a fundamentalist mindset. A mindset that, in the case of the Afghans, it's also a combination of tribalism and a mythical sense that religion provides you with a sense of rootedness and essence, a stability, absolute truths in the face of whether it is the vicissitudes of time, of war on the one hand, or of modernity on the other. But I dare say that it is not a mindset that is peculiar to the Taliban or to Muslims. It's a mindset that at its raw manifestations you see in the Jerry Falwells, you see it in the Pat Robinsons, and I dare say you also see it in the discourse of your president. This whole caricaturing of absolute rightness, absolute goodness on the one side and absolute evil on the other side. I mean, really, this is the shades of the same coin. But you didn't ask me about your president. You asked me about Islam. And the reality is that that there are many strands in Islam, as Edward Said says. I, for example, have spent much of my life working against all forms of religious fundamentalism. I don't like the term moderate. I'm not a moderate. I'm a radical Muslim. I am bitterly opposed to all forms of religious obscurantism. I hate all forms of discrimination, whether it is against transvestites or transgendered people or gay or homosexual people or women or black people. And I've spent my life opposing all forms of discrimination. I don't like the equation of an Islam that stands for justice with a wishy-washy Islam that doesn't take positions. I think that I don't like the idea that people, I mean, are all of a sudden saying that there is an Islam which is peaceful. Of course there is such an Islam, but it is not the Islam of the Saudi establishment. It's also not the Islam of President Bush. I believe in an Islam that is prepared to wage struggles for justice. In South Africa, for example, we speak about the gender jihad. There are many, many mosques in South Africa, where women aren't allowed to worship. And it is a sacred struggle to ensure that women have their legitimate places within society as a whole, but also within our mosques. And so I'm also a Muslim that believes in jihad. I know it's not a very attractive thing to be saying, but I think that in a world where there is so much injustice, for us to say that we are moderates in the face of this injustice, this is acquiescence, this is an evil.
Explain what is meant by jihad.
Jihad literally means a sacred struggle. And for me, it is a struggle to establish justice in the world, but not a justice for Muslims, not a justice for white men, not a justice for men, but a justice for the very many marginalized people that exist in the world. And this may change from society to society. If, for example, I would be sitting in Paris with a whole bunch of middle-class Arab men, the marginalized in that context may well be Jews that they are demonizing or engaging in a whole blanket rubbishing of and kill the Jews. I would not hesitate to, in that context, speak my truths. And the Prophet, for example, said in a hadith, in a prophetic saying, that the best jihad is to speak the truth in the face of tyranny. And that, in that context, it is that kind of tyranny. I do, however, think that this kind of, more specifically, if you were to ask me if what the Taliban is engaging in or what Osama is engaging in is a jihad, no, I don't. I think this whole, it is not, there is no intention to establish a just order. The way in which they've dealt certainly with women in Afghanistan, the way they engage in the blanket rubbishing of all Jews and Christians and people who don't believe, the way they have stoned to death people that have been quote-unquote caught in male-male sexual acts in the Sudan, in Afghanistan, all of those testifies to the fact that the world that they seek to create is even more horrific than the world that they seek to destroy. And so, no, it is not a jihad. Jihad has two forms. The one jihad is a struggle against yourself, and the other jihad is a struggle against all forms of tyranny around you.
We're talking to Farid Isaac. His book is Quran, Liberation and Pluralism. He is a longtime freedom fighter in South Africa, leader in the ANC, the African National Congress, who is the commissioner of the Commission on Gender Equality over the last 4 years in South Africa. And as he's just said, trained for many years in the madras of Pakistan, where a number of the Taliban also were educated. Let's go back to that. Can you talk about who these men are?
One of the things about madrasa life in general is that broken people generally take to madrasa education. And that's not a bad thing in itself. I think that many people in Christianity take to the ministry because their lives are broken and they're seeking for wholeness. But this is compounded in this particular case with enormous poverty. But one should also bear in mind that the Taliban are the children of war, that they are the children of broken families, they are the children of refugees, they are the dispossessed chickens that are coming home to roost. And I don't think that it is savvy to ignore this whole legacy of refugeeness, of poverty, of devastation, and a war that was visited upon these people by the major powers at that time, one of them still around and one of them not around. And so when we see a social, a cohesiveness given to all of this brokenness, it is the children of war, the children of a violent, CIA-funded resistance to a war, but also the children of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. this coalescing with ancient tribal machoism, the Taliban is the product of this, and I dare say, and I shouldn't excuse my own myself and my religious commitment, I think also the children of some violent impulses within our own faith, Islam. I think that it is dishonest on the part of many Muslims today to say that Islam is only about peace. The reality is that Islam, my religious background, it has violent strands in it that I, as a Muslim theologian, would have to confront and to think about, and what do we do with it. But I think that going the easy way and saying that Islam means peace, I don't believe that I would be truthful to my own conscience if I were to go that path.
Who is, for example, Mullah Muhammad Omar?
Mullah Muhammad Omar is not a very profound religious scholar. He was a local imam in Kandahar, studied in one of the madrasas in Pakistan, in the vacuum of his of Kandahar, the power vacuum that was there, or the chaos, the chaos of the Mujahideen government and so on. Mullah Umar, with his religious students in his own little madrasa in Kandahar, one day decided to organize people, and through that mobilized people against local corruption and so on. But I also think that it's important to bear in mind that often we personalize these things. But it's also the product of a whole nexus, the Pakistani intelligence agency and their own need for stability in Afghanistan, given the complex nature of the Pashtun dominance in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan and Quetta, and the tensions there and the separatist movement there with the south of Afghanistan. So it's a whole interaction of other forces at play there.
And what does Taliban mean?
Taliban literally means students, normally applied to students of religious education. A talib is somebody in search, meaning in search of religious learning. Well, I mean, I think that they have a long time ago thought or worked on the assumption that they have found everything. And I think everybody in this world that has found all the solutions, I think they're a pretty dangerous breed, whether they're in Islam or elsewhere.
And madrasa, what does it mean?
Madrasa is a religious seminary. These madrasas, they run very much along the lines of 16th, 17th, 18th century Catholic seminaries. I mean, where for 6 days a week, we spend 8 hours a day in classes. We spend another 4 hours in compulsory learning. Our hostel rooms, we live 10 to 16 people in one room, and it's not a large room. They locked until 10 o'clock at night. Only then can we enter the rooms. We get awoken at 4 or 5 in the morning for prayers, a very rigid kind of regime.
And
we're not allowed to read newspapers.
And what does it mean not to have any girls there, any women?
Oh, I think that it's not just a question of not having any women there, but just a question of putting all of these men together. And exactly the same thing happens when you put men together in a prison or in a boarding school. In this particular case, with much more repression, of course, but it leads to distorted personalities. You begin to develop images of women as women just represent temptation, women just represent evil, women just represent threats to your sexual so-called purity. At the end of the day, I think it's understandable how this is reinforced then by the nature of ancient tribal societies. I mean, you know, in the northwest frontier province where many of the Pashtuns live, I've been there a couple of times, and people talk with pride of Chadar and Chardiwari, that the Chadar is the black, the covering that women wear, and Chardiwari is four walls. People speak with pride about how their women are locked up behind these cloaks and four walls since the age of 8 or 9. And had never seen the sunlight. But sadly, we didn't develop an awareness or not a sufficient enough awareness to actually do something about it until things started falling apart downtown in our own terrain. And so, this is the tragedy, I mean, of the struggle of many, many women. people don't notice it until it doesn't affect men. It's only when men are affected or men's sense of power is affected. It's only then that all of a sudden we see a whole barrage of coverage on the plight of these poor women in Afghanistan.
We're talking to Farid Isak, and he was the head of the Commission of Gender Equality in South Africa for the last 4 years. Went from South Africa, where he was a leader in the ANC, then in the government, and before that, in Pakistan. I'd like to talk to you about the transition you made there. And we're going to also talk about U.S. foreign policy when we come back here on the War and Peace Report. You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're here with Farid Isak. He's in the United States as a visiting professor of theology at Auburn Seminary in New York. He's a leading Muslim figure in the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, a prominent Muslim scholar, and author of the book Quran, Liberation, and Pluralism, an Islamic perspective of interreligious solidarity against oppression. He was educated for 8 years in the madrasas of Pakistan, where he knew a number of the people who are in the Taliban leadership right now in Afghanistan. Is there someone you'd like to talk about that you knew that's there now that you're following in the news?
No, not particularly. In part because, I mean, one of the problems that I have, Amy, is we often tend to personalize these things and we say, you know, it's like the story of the bad king and the good king. And once upon a time, there was this bad king, and his name was Gaddafi. And after him or before him, there was another bad king. His name was Khomeini. And then another bad king came, and his name was Saddam Hussein. And now we've got another bad king. His name is Osama. And then there was a good king before, and his name was George Bush. And he really whipped the ass of the bad king. And then his son came along afterwards. The baby bear came along and then whipped the ass of the other bad king. I think that we tend to, we often reduce history to a whole drama of bad kings and good kings, whereas there are many, many other forces that, of course, this kind of thing makes for good TV coverage and good simplistic analysis of things and so on. But the reality is that there are many, many other forces at work that gives rise to these things and that shape our responses to these things. When you look, for example, at the whole Gulf War and so on, at the end of the day, it was about gas and the price of petrol in the United States and nothing about freeing Kuwait. Kuwait is still as much enslaved as Kuwait was before and afterwards.
And Saddam Hussein is still
Saddam
in
Hussein
Iraq.
Saddam Hussein is still around. Gaddafi is now a friend of ours. The other bad king's son took over in Syria, and his son is equally bad but has just been elected onto the Security Council of the United Nations without the veto of the UN. Then we had the other bad king, of course, there in Sudan, Turabi, still around recently. They've been taken off our list of terror-supporting nations. So it depends entirely on which way we want to go and who serves our interests at a particular time.
Well, I'd like to talk more personally about you. How did you go from South Africa to Pakistan?
I was a child, always deeply religious, but also always had a very strong political awareness, a sense of injustice around me. In fact, Amy, I was 13 years old when I first went to jail, when I was picked up at school by the security police and detained.
And where were you?
I was in Bontevel, in a poor township. I come from a very impoverished background in South Africa. But I also had I had a sense that of the power of religion over people, and in some ways, I think, like many other people who take to religion, also a broken person, if truth be told, and also seeking for wholeness within religion. And so I was about 15 years old when I went to Pakistan to go and study and live in this. But you can also imagine the devastation that it wreaks on a 15-year-old to be living in an environment like this. And I was there until I was 23 years old, came back, was principal of another seminary in South Africa. And after just a year, the liberation struggle was really taking off in a big way, and I simply couldn't see myself trapped in a seminary. It was then that I founded an organization called the Call of Islam that played perhaps the leading role in mobilizing Muslims in the struggle against apartheid. But interestingly, I had two other platforms. The one was gender justice, and the other one was environmental justice. And so for much of the 80s, I spent my life either in and out of detention or in the trenches of the liberation struggle.
And what about that, in the trenches of the liberation struggle? The ANC, considered, let's not forget, in this country, a terrorist organization for many years, and even with the laws passed now, since September 11th, that talk about if you have ever in the past aided a terrorist organization, that would include the ANC.
And that would include the icon of humanity in the world today, Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela, we must not forget, Nelson could have been freed from jail at least 10 years before he came out. But Mandela refused to denounce in a principled manner the armed struggle. And so, yes, the ANC also has a history of armed struggle, for want of a better word, if truth be told, a history of violence. And it may now be easy for us to denounce all forms of violence, as I, for example, am wont to do. And at the same time, I think that it was useful for us in our liberation struggle. But Amy, I must say that since then, I have seen how even on our own side, those cadres of ours, those comrades of ours, I have seen what it has done to them. I have seen how, you know, people often talk about the miracle of South African society, how, oh, isn't it wonderful that you guys avoided this bloodbath? We haven't. If you look at the gender violence in South Africa, if you look at the horrific rape figures in South Africa, if you look at the domestic abuse figures in South Africa, that war is continuing in our homes. And so I think that we are still seeing the cheapening of human life under apartheid. But I'll be honest, Amy, we are also seeing how we in the liberation struggle glorified violence. And so if I had a chance to live my life over again, I would be very, very careful before I again support an armed struggle. I would think very hard about whether people are just taps that you can turn on and off. The one moment you say jihad against apartheid, and you know that the subtext of it is a violent struggle against apartheid, and the next moment you say, okay guys, cool it now, the jihad is over, back to normal. Because people tend to often internalize, I mean, violent ways of doing things. But again, I mean, I would say if I were to live my life again, I'm not quite sure if I would to would I be able to arrogate to myself the right to go and tell this to somebody in Palestine, for example. I know I'm going on and on, but let me just make one quick point. You know, my niece, she was very young. She was 12 years old when she was snatched from her bedroom in the middle of the night by somebody that had broken into the window, taken across to a field and raped on the field at knife point. In the middle of this, she had the presence of mind to, when the rapist dropped his knife, she took the knife, and it's a very gory incident to be narrating, but this is the reality of the world that we're living in. And she stabbed him in his back. He jumped up, and she then ran. I don't know, Amy, with all my post hoc insights into violence and understanding of what it does to people, I don't know if I would be able to tell my niece then, you should not have used the knife of that man to save yourself from being raped any further. I'm saying that I have all of these insights now, but I don't know if I can glibly go around the world and tell other people how they should be dealing with their own struggles for humanity and for justice.
We're talking to Farid Isaac, who is a Muslim liberation theologian from South Africa to Pakistan, South Africa, now here in the United States. You became head of the Commission on Gender Equality.
Chief Executive Officer, yes.
CEO. What was that commission, and how does that fit into your life and your religion?
I was 3 weeks old when my father left my mother with six sons. And then I was about 4 or 5 years old when, under the Group Areas Act, we were thrown literally into the wilderness, leaving a stable community because we had to make place for white people in that area. And then I was at school when my mother died of a heart attack on the factory floor. She left very early in the morning from what we say to can't see, and she returned home at night after can't see, from dark to dark. And then there's a very painful story also. When I returned from Pakistan, in my early 20s, I was called into a room by one of my brothers and says, look, Farid, there's something that we must tell you. And we have a sister. What do you mean we have a sister? My mother actually had a daughter before she was married. But the shame and disgust and the horror and the evil of having a child before you are married. And of course, we say, you know, she became pregnant. It's never he impregnated her. We talk about women as if they're all Virgin Marys, you know, immaculate conceptions. Men aren't responsible for it. It's just women who become pregnant, isn't it? And so this woman, her existence was buried all our lives until after my mother died. And so all of these things really also go into who I am. And so in many ways, my own commitment to gender equality is in some ways this woman, this mother of mine who died, and this is not a cliche for us, as a victim of the triple oppression of women, patriarchy, apartheid, and gender. So my life is a continuation of the struggle for integrity and the struggle of existence that my own mother led. As for the Commission on Gender Equality, the South African Constitution is a wonderful constitution, perhaps the most progressive in the world. But it also seeks to create institutions that will ensure that notions of non-racialism, notions of non-sexism, that these notions become real in our society. And so to this end, the Constitution has set up several commissions, the Human Rights Commission, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and the Commission for Gender Equality. And so it's a constitutional organ. I mean, we get nominated by the public, interviewed in Parliament, and eventually appointed by the President.
The Constitution is one of the most progressive when it comes to women and also gays and lesbians.
Yes, absolutely. The South African Constitution was the first constitution in the world that outlawed discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. The very first, I mean, in many other countries you've got laws against such discrimination. The South African Constitution was the only one that enshrined it in its constitution. Just two things about that. Our then President Mandela was very, very clear about this, and certainly said that never again will any group discriminate against another group. As a Muslim theologian, of course, it's a bit of a difficult one sometimes, because, you know, our legacy, our theological legacy and our scriptures end, has what we sometimes think are explicit positions on this. I don't believe that these positions are explicit as what we make them out to be. But then I think we need to be honest. Muslims can't, in a new South Africa, demand a say for them as Muslims and then want to say, we want space to be, to live our own lives out. And then say, yes, but those other types, faggots and queers, blah, 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 whatever derogatory terms we have for them, or not so derogatory terms, they can't have the space to be who they are. And I'm not saying that you don't get Muslims who are gays. I'm not saying that the one is not the other.
And AIDS is a major crisis in South Africa, as in many places in the world. How does that fit into the issue of gender?
Incidentally, I'm also a trustee of the Treatment Action Campaign. I'm one of three trustees. And the Treatment Action Campaign, you may be aware, led the struggle in the last few years against the pharmaceutical industries. And not in response to your question, but what has really angered me in the last days, it makes me feel bitter, in fact, is that for years we're waging the struggle in a continent that has two-thirds of the world's HIV population, HIV-positive population. For years we wage a struggle against the pharmaceutical industry, against patent rights and so on. All of a sudden, two people die in the USA because of anthrax, and the USA is threatening to revoke the patent rights of the company that holds these rights. It is horrific. Two people have died. Two Americans have died. And the USA is putting pressure on the pharmaceutical industry, reduce your prices, threatening that Congress will pass laws to void and denounce the to void the patent rights of Cipro or whatever the
Cipro
of Cipro
the Bayer Corporation
of Cipro Bayer, and then threatened us with economic sanctions. And I called last year for the illegal importation, the smuggling. I publicly called for the smuggling of cheaper antiretrovirals from Thailand for women who are HIV positive into South Africa. And we have initiated a movement of civil disobedience in South Africa to smuggle these drugs in. But it is very, very painful. I get very, very angry about this. In South Africa, of course, you know, well, in Africa in large, you know that the larger part of people that are HIV positive, they are women. In part, it is a reflection of both the economic vulnerability of women and the vulnerability of women in relationships. Women simply cannot negotiate safer sex with their husbands. It is also seen, you know, in broken societies, men, not only broken, but in throughout our patriarchy, our senses of who we are, the machoism, I am a man, the whole way in which this plays out in sexual relations. All of this means that women are the disempowered people. Women are vulnerable. And so in South Africa, in Africa at large, the question of this thing is not one of HIV AIDS, is not one of sexual morality, of what is right and what is wrong, but it is a matter of life and death. And if it deals with morality, then it is the morality or the immorality of gender injustice rather than this narrow obsession that religionists have about who uses what part of his anatomy to go into which part of whose anatomy on the other side.
We're talking to Farid Isaac, who is a leading South African liberation activist and liberation theologian who is Muslim and has written the book Quran, Liberation and Pluralism. You're here in the United States. You're going to be spending time here. You're going to be going to Palestine as well. Where?
I'll be based in Jerusalem next year for about 2.5 months. We always say, God willing, inshallah. And in this particular case, the controllers of passports and entries and so on at Tel Aviv Airport also willing. And I've always felt very passionately about the Palestinian struggle. indeed as passionately as what I feel about the struggle to humanize all people. And why I'm saying this, Amy, is very often you have Muslims that feel passionately about the Palestinian struggle, but in a very, I think, in a very dishonest way. It's only because Muslims are suffering there. I think that when people are suffering all over, whether they are Jews or Muslims or Christians, as a human being, forget about as a Muslim, I should not be silent. And so I am vociferous in my denunciation of anti-Semitism. And it's a terrible thing amongst Muslims. It's a very insidious thing, anti-Jewishness. Anything goes wrong, you blame the Jews. But at the same time, one of the other interesting things that I find is every right-winger, from Japanese nationalism to Afrikaner racism, nearly every right-wing cause in the world always resort to the Jews as a final scapegoat.
For Ida Sack, we have to break. We'll be back in a minute.
What the world needs now is love, sweet love. It's the only thing that there's just too little of. What the world needs now is love, sweet love. No, not just for some, but for everyone. Lord, we don't need another meadow. There are cornfields and wheat fields enough to grow. There are sunbeams and moonbeams enough to shine. Oh, listen, Lord, if you want to know.
You're listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation with the Muslim liberation theologian Fareed Isaac. If you were president of the United States, what would you do now?
First of all, I don't think that I'd ever want to have the dubious honor of leading the United States of America.
Well, you don't have to worry about being elected these days in the United States. That's not what it takes, a popular election, to be president of the United States.
Yeah, and the other thing, of course, is one doesn't have to worry about having the support of the majority of people. The majority of people just don't vote in the United States. I think that one just has to be clear that you have the support of the correct lobbies in the United States. Not that that's really important, because lobbies also make sure that they have their bread buttered on all different sides. And so whoever comes in really is our man. But suppose we came to the leadership in a different kind of process, in a democratic process. I don't know. I think that one of the first things that I would do is I would enact laws that would talk to people, not laws to talk to people, but I would try to create a United States that is less great. I would try to create a United States that is smaller. I would try to create a United States that is less grand. The reality is this, that with 4% of the world's population and consuming 46% of the world's resources, we will always be having trouble. And it is natural. It is to be expected. It's not being vindictive when you say that if you comprise 4% of the world's population and walk away with 46% of its resources, it's a law of nature that you will get your comeuppance. I'm not saying that I want it like that, but no person does this and not face the consequences of it. So I would ask the country and work with the country on how do we become less great.
Conservatives in this country and in the Islamic world have talked about a clash of civilizations between the West and Muslim countries. You instead have talked about a clash of fundamentalisms. Can you explain what you mean by this?
I think that we generally have a picture of what we talk about when we speak about religious fundamentalism. Christian fundamentalism, Jewish fundamentalism, or Muslim fundamentalism. We have a pretty broad picture of what we mean when we talk about that. I have another theory, and that is that the market also operates as a religious fundamentalism. The market, certainly as we know it today in the era of globalization, it has a god. What is a god? A god is an entity that is the focus of your existence, that you try to please, that permeates your being, that you seek to worship. In the market, capital is at the center of our existences. You accumulate capital, you serve the interests of capital. Capital is the big value that determines your own worth as a human being. We judge people by how much wealth they have. That guy has made it. She's a very successful woman. And by successful, we don't mean is she a balanced person or a balanced personality, pleasant, unpleasant, good character, bad character. No. Successful is big bucks. And so you've got a religion. You've got a god at the center of it. But you also have religious symbols. You've got your McDonald's sign. You've got your Coke sign. And these symbols are very, very important. They are protected by patent rights. They are my symbols. Don't get into my territory. You have temples where people spend their time reflection, meditating, worshipping. How much? The shopping malls, for example. These are our temples. You also have the most pernicious aspect of fundamentalism is its sense of self. And its sense of how it excludes other people. And so there is paradise for some and there is eternal hell for others. You don't want to buy into the market economy? There is absolute hell for you. Any economy in the third world that doesn't adopt the standards of the IMF, the standards of the World Trade Organization, there is absolute hell for you. If we don't squeeze you out completely, we will impose embargoes upon you. The case of Cuba, for example, is a pointed example. And so we promise paradise for some, and for many, we promise utter hell. We promise paradise for most. But we also know that paradise is an elusive thing. At the end of the day, there is just paradise for a few. I mean, the world just has so much. The world doesn't have more than what it has. But it holds out the hope of paradise for the vast majority of people. You can get rich. It's like the lottery. People know that they've got 1 in 2 million chance of winning the lottery, but there is the hope. And religion functions in very much the same way. It holds out the sense of hope. And so, Amy, I believe that what we had seen on September the 11th is really a very vivid manifestation of the clash of a Muslim fundamentalism with the fundamentalism of the market. And terrified as I am of Muslim fundamentalism as a Muslim, I must also say that I'm equally terrified of the fundamentalism of the market. We have seen what it has done to Africa. We have seen what it has done to Latin America. We've seen what it has done to Asia. And so I live in dread of both. Of course, when a Jehovah's Witness comes up to you on the street and gives you a pamphlet and says, take this, or I am chosen, you are frozen, it's my task to defrost you, you immediately say, no, I don't want it. But somebody comes to you and hands out to you, you know, here's the latest sale at Sainsbury or Bloomsbury or whatever, you take it. And so they have their proselytizers, their converts, I mean, the huge amounts of money that is spent on proselytizing. It's not called ads anymore. They just called, and will you hold on for the next message from our sponsors? Not even called an ad anymore. And so they've got their pamphlets, they've got their tracts, they've got their missionaries, and they're every bit as pernicious as what Muslim or Christian or Jewish fundamentalism is.
So what do you think should happen now? We're now, I don't know if you can call it at war with Afghanistan, but the United States government is bombing Afghanistan. They're also dropping some food on Afghanistan and some pamphlets.
I don't think that they were ever serious about dropping food. I don't think that anybody was really taken in by it, except for the Jerry Springers of this world and your other people of that ilk, kind of humanitarian. We're giving food to the Afghans, but it was a ploy. 37,000 meals. It was a ploy that just happened on the first day, so nobody was ever taken in by it. I think that this cup will come to pass. We'll sit through it. I mean, I was at an anti-war rally a few days ago in San Francisco. It was wonderful. I think that it's amazing that there are voices, isolated as they may be, that are continuing to speak. But we're speaking more for the crime of being silent. But this cup shall come to pass, and then after that, people like me and you, people like the listeners of this radio, other people throughout the world who are committed to creating a just world, a world where it is safe to be children, we shall pick up the pieces and continue to engage in our struggles. And yeah.
Will you continue to speak out against the bombing?
Absolutely. I think that not because we're going to succeed. You know, Amy, in the years of struggle against apartheid, we didn't fight that battle because we knew we were going to win. We had no idea we would see a non-racial and a non-sexist South Africa in our lifetime. But we fought because our integrity was at stake. And so we're speaking against the war, not because anybody is going to listen, but we're speaking against the war for us to retain our faith in ourselves as human beings.
Fareed Isaak, he is a leading anti-apartheid figure in South Africa, spent 4 years as the head of South Africa's Commission on Gender Equality, and a leading Muslim liberation theologian. His books include Quran, Liberation and Pluralism, and On Being a Muslim. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a video cassette copy of this interview or a video of Noam Chomsky's speech or the speech we played earlier this week by Howard Zinn against war, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. Or you can go to the website and get the video cassettes at freespeech.org. And this latest news just in from the Pacifica home front. According to the Pacifica board chair, Bob Farrell, the executive director of Pacifica, Bessie Wash, has resigned. This news comes after Pacifica board member Pete Bramson said last night that he had been told that Bessie Wash had been fired. And that does it for the show. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro, and engineer Errol Maitland is at WBIX.org, where you can hear Democracy Now! You can also hear us at webactive.com. Special thanks to Amy Pomerlo at KPFA, Free Speech Radio news producer Aaron Glantz, and thanks to everyone at KPFA and affiliate station KFCF in Fresno, and to all the Pacifica affiliate stations. We are Pacifica. Special thanks to the Independent Media Center and our hosts here at Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Suno. We can be heard here in New York at WFMU 91.1 FM every night at 7 and on Manhattan Neighborhood Network Channel 56. We're broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. We're in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Lord, we don't need another meadow. There are cornfields and wheat fields enough to grow. There are sunbeams and moonbeams enough to shine. Oh, listen, Lord, if you want to know. There's just too little of what the world needs now is love, sweet love. No, not just for some, oh, but just for every, everyone.